This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
WBAI.
Buddy, you're a boy, make a big noise, playing in the street, gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace, kicking your can all over the place.
Get ready, April 10th, be there at Arlene's Grocery for WBAI's Artsy Fartsy Battle of the Bands. Attention all bands, get your submissions in now at WBAI.org. Be there as New York's hottest young acts get together and battle it out for cash and prizes. And also join us for an exciting after party. Be there April 10th. Get your submissions in now at WBAI.org and be a part of the hottest Battle of the Bands of all time. April 10th at Arlene's Grocery. It's gonna go down for prizes. The WBAI's Artsy Fartsy Battle of the Bands.
WBAI New York, 9 p.m. 01. Time for Tahrir.
Good evening, friends. It's 9:02 p.m. on Tuesday, March 22nd, 2011, and we welcome you to Radio Tahrir, Voices of the Arab and Muslim Community Here and Abroad. Tahrir means liberation. I'm Sara Malaika, your host today, here with my co-host, Sadia Aslam. And we would like to wish you a Happy New Year for those of you celebrating Nowruz. It's the beginning of spring and a new year. Coming up in the next hour, the new McCarthyism, a report on New York Congressman Peter King's controversial hearings on what he calls the radicalization of the American Muslim community. And we'll speak to writer and theater artist Niloufar Talebi on the upcoming world premiere of Atash Surushan, Fire Angels. All this and more coming up here on 99.5 FM WBAI, streaming live at WBAI.org. And to start off this evening, we'll be hearing a track from the CD Faryad Masters of Persian Music, featuring Mohammad Reza Shajarian, Hossein Alizadeh, Kehan Kalhor, and Humayun Shajarian.
جز این قدر نتوان
And uprisings across the Arab world continue today as citizens attempt to overthrow authoritarian regimes. Yemen's ambassador to the United Nations, Abdullah Al-Saidi, has resigned, the latest high-ranking official to quit in protest against the killing of dozens of protesters by the government of Ali Abdullah Saleh. In Libya, Britain, France, and the U.S. have agreed that NATO will take over the military command of the no-fly zone over Libya. And in Bahrain, the total number of deaths since the start of protests for more than 30 days now has reached 20. The opposition group Wafaq has reported that 100 people remain missing as Bahraini forces have put down an uprising that prompted the king to impose martial law and call in military forces from neighboring countries, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. And now for our first segment this evening on Radio Tahrir.
And now we turn to our discussion of what is being referred to as the new McCarthyism, namely New York Congressman Peter King's controversial hearings on what he calls the radicalization of the American Muslim community and that community's response. King, also the chairman of the Committee on Homeland Security, began the hearings earlier this month. First, we're going to play a clip for you from Peter King's opening statements, and it's about a minute and a half.
Some of this opposition, such as my colleague and friends, Mr. Ellis and Mr. Pascrell, has been measured and thoughtful. Other opposition, both from special interest groups and the media, has ranged from disbelief to paroxysms of rage and hysteria. Let me make it clear today that I remain convinced that these hearings must go forward, and they will. To back down would be a craven surrender to political correctness and an abdication of what I believe to be the main responsibility of this committee, to protect America from a terrorist attack. Despite what passes for conventional wisdom in certain circles, there is nothing radical or un-American in holding these hearings. Indeed, congressional investigation of Muslim American radicalization is the logical response to the repeated and urgent warnings which the Obama administration has been making in recent months. Just this past Sunday, for instance, Dennis McDonough, the Deputy National Security Advisor to President Obama, made a major speech on radicalization, stating that, quote, Al-Qaeda and its adherents have increasingly turned to another troubling tactic, attempting to recruit and radicalize people to terrorism here in the United States.
And that was the clip of Congressman Peter King's opening statements from the hearings earlier this month. Next, we have a clip of Congressman Keith Ellison's response. He is the first Muslim American congressman, and he offered powerful testimony refuting the basis of the King hearings.
Mr. Ellison.
Thank you, Chairman King, for allowing me to testify today. Though the chairman and I sometimes do disagree, including on the aspects of this hearing, I appreciate his willingness to engage in this dialogue. Let me also thank the ranking member, Ranking Member Thompson, for his commitment to Homeland Security and Civil Rights for All. It's a challenge to protect both security and liberty, but Congressman Thompson seems to strike the right balance. I'd like to introduce Talat Hamdani, who is with us today. She's a brave mother of Mohammed Salman Hamdani, a first responder who died trying to rescue fellow Americans on 9/11. I'd like to make three points today, Mr. Chairman. First, violent extremism is a serious concern to all Americans and is the legitimate business of this committee. Second, this committee's approach to this particular subject, I believe, is contrary to the best of American values and threatens our security, or could potentially. Finally, we need increased understanding and engagement with the Muslim community in order to keep America safe. Let me elaborate on my first point. Understanding the roots of domestic terrorism is the legitimate business of the House Homeland Security Committee. I share the chairman's concern about violent extremism. I voted for the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007, authored by Representative Jane Harman. This bill was a common-sense approach to studying violent extremism in the United States. After gathering more feedback from the community, I expect to introduce a similar bill in the future. I recently made a presentation sponsored by the Center for American Progress called Strengthening American Security, Identifying, Preventing, and Responding to Domestic Terrorism. My presentation there addressed causes of violent extremism and solutions for prevention and intervention. The safety of our families and communities is at stake in our discussion today. We should apply the utmost professionalism to this issue, which leads me to my second point. We need to conduct a thorough, fair analysis and to do no harm. The approach of today's hearing, I fear, does not meet these standards. Today's hearing is entitled "The Extent of Radicalization of the American Muslim Community and That Community's Response."
And that was a sample of Congressman Keith Ellison's testimony at the hearings. Here to discuss Congressman King's hearings, we have with us on the phone from Seattle, Dr. Karim Dana, co-principal investigator of the Muslim American Public Opinion Survey, or MAPOS. Dr. Dana is also a Dubai Initiative Research Fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He is also a faculty member at Tufts University, where he teaches a course on Middle Eastern history and politics. Dr. Dana, thank you for joining us here on Radio Tahrir.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm here with my co-host, Sara Malaika, and my name is Sadia Aslam, for those of you who are just joining us. Dr. Dana, tell us, what is your response to these hearings held by Congressman Peter King?
Well, as someone who's actually done research on the Muslim American population in the United States, and my colleague Matt Barreto and I, we conducted the largest survey of Muslim Americans in the United States with a sample size of 1,410. We were actually quite shocked, in fact, by the call for these particular hearings, simply because our findings, in fact, suggest the opposite of that. So we're here to basically show, you know, that numbers, in fact, do not support the idea that mosques do present an idea whereby individuals who attend the mosque are more, quote-unquote, radicalized. We're actually becoming more of individuals who actually have hostility towards non-Muslims. Our sample suggests that the mosque attendance, in fact, increases the participation of the Muslim American community in American politics.
And Dr. Dana, what years were your research conducted from?
Well, we started in December of 2006 through December of 2008, and we've been looking throughout the data set ever since then. And we look at various important aspects in terms of the compatibility of whether a person can be a Muslim and living in Western societies or the United States of America and so on. One of the interesting findings is that 77% of those who do not attend the mosque at all, in fact, tend to believe that there's a compatibility between the teachings of Islam and the American political system. Now, with the theft of the mosque, from 77%, that jumps to 95%, which actually translated into a 53% increase in mosque attendance. Therefore, the mosque, in fact, has a very positive effect in American society, not only for Muslim Americans, but in general for American politics.
So, Dr. Donna, how do we respond to Congressman King's statement that the Muslim American community is not doing enough to combat the radicalization, which does exist in parts of our community?
Well, what's interesting is that what he's been using in terms of evidence, as he calls evidence, is not are actually more of anecdotes as opposed to numbers or data. And in fact, I find it hard to actually believe that there's data to suggest what he's suggesting. I mean, I understand that there's radicalization of some sort, or actually a better word than that would be, impact of creating more of a fundamentalist element. There's no data to support that in terms of hard numbers and empirical evidence to suggest that. So I actually worry that this would become more of a partisan politics, whereby the Republican Party would basically take that sort of a position compared to the Democratic Party, represented in this particular case by Congressman Allison.
So if this continues in the next, let's say, every 3 to 4 months, Muslim Americans are put in a situation where they feel the need they have to come out and defend themselves, whether or not the accusations are either anecdotal or based on data, what is the best way to respond to this?
Well, I think, again, this is the United States of America, where religion, the practice of religion is what really this country stands for. One thing that is quite interesting is that Muslims have actually been quite isolated, in my opinion, in this particular case, whereby Muslim Americans have to defend themselves, that they are actually good Americans, compared to, the Jewish American population, for example, the Latino American population, or German Catholics, for example, Irish Catholics, and so on, and Italian Catholics, who actually do not necessarily have to deal with this. Now, interestingly enough, those various religious minority groups have actually dealt with those sorts of problems in the past, over the past few decades. Now, it seems to be that this is actually the case of Muslims, whereby Muslims are being singled out. And my worry is that, this will, again, become more of a partisan politics sort of a position, whereby Republicans would take a position and Democrats take another, instead of actually thinking the questions of what is more more American of a position versus, what America stands for. So in terms of what we actually should do in these situations, if something like this happens, as a scholar myself, as an independent scholar, I will continue to conduct my research and see, the impact of this in terms of how would the Republican Party react to certain things and versus the Democratic Party and their constituents, basically.
Dr. Karam, I think it's also important to note, though, that these ideas and stereotypes about American Muslims cross all different kinds of political groups and political entities in this country. I don't think it's just the conservatives or and less so the liberals. I think there's a widespread stereotyping of Muslims today. And I mean, we see that in the conservative parts of the country, but also by, very moderate people in Congress and are supposedly moderate people in the mainstream media and in the government.
I agree with you entirely, and I think this is actually not a problem that this problem didn't start a year or two ago, and it certainly did not start with the Peter King hearings. This is actually, it seems to be fitting in a larger process whereby, in terms of media, covering Islam has been problematic for the past few decades. Whether or not this is a partisan issue or not, again, this is subject to debate. But one thing that I would like to mention here is that in 2000, for example, it was the first time that the Muslim American community overwhelmingly voted for George W. Bush and voted for the Republican candidate. Now, soon after that, and it is shown in our data, that close to 30% of those who were surveyed throughout the United States, they actually do not prescribe to any political party. They're not even independents anymore. They're actually they feel that the system is actually rejecting them, which I think is a serious problem for those strategists in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. So, you know, this is a larger sort of a problem from of course, partisan politics. This is a societal problem that we have to address. And Muslim Americans happen to be, you know, isolated today, and it's a big problem. And I think, you know, this is a very important question to be addressed over and over. And I hope that, you know, the hearings would actually cease to exist then, because they're actually not helping. In fact, they're hurting, and they're isolating a community of Americans who are law-abiding citizens, and actually, you know, serve in wars and so on, and actually isolating them and making them very visible in society. And that's, in my opinion, wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's very isolating for people who are, you know, just trying to be regular people in this society.
Is regular in this? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just to be a person living in a country, and to having to constantly defend your existence, your religion, your color, your language, your nation of origin. I mean, it's very stressful on our communities these days.
And it is very stressful. But I mean, what is it to live as an ordinary citizen? I mean, look at other various communities that live throughout the United States. I mean, 100 years ago, Italian Americans were actually facing serious forms of discrimination in New York City. The same thing with the Jewish American population. Now,
I think all populations at one point or another.
Sadly, and this country is based on immigration, and immigrants, you know, the influx of immigrants continues making this country a great country in that sense. And it is problematic. And one thing that people have to understand, I think, is that, you know, a Muslim doesn't come from one particular place. Muslims, as you very well know, are a diverse population. We speak more than 20 languages and come from, you know, all continents on earth. And interestingly enough, Muslims have actually existed since the early days of America. One example of this is Alexander Russell Webb, who basically was, in fact, from the Northeast, who was one of the early converts to Islam, and in fact was one of the very early ambassadors to the Philippines, U.S. ambassadors to the Philippines. So we're talking a 19th century Caucasian man from the Northeast who ends up becoming Muslim and actually, you know, becoming a diplomat on behalf of the United States. Now, these are things that we don't necessarily hear about, and we do not kind of discuss in terms of, you know, within our popular culture these days, which, in fact, I think that we need to address the importance of Muslims in the context of the United States, both in terms of culture and its diplomatic history.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mustafa Bayoumi on March 10th wrote an article in The Nation, and he says that this supposed widespread radicalization of American Muslims and their quote-unquote stealth jihad are paranoid fantasies that are being paraded about as political truths. Do you agree that these are paranoid fantasies?
Well, I mean, in some ways I agree, but in some others I disagree. Again, we have to speak to Mr. Bayoumi to address those specifically. But I think, you know, I probably wouldn't be far away from the truth to basically say that it seems that there's more and more, increasingly, there's a push towards making this into a political situation whereby, you know, either you are with the Muslims or would not, or not an American, basically. So, and it's actually a very serious situation. I mean, are those fantasies of jihadists that drive political agendas? Again, one thing that, you know, that we all agree on is that, you know, 9/11 was a very terrible day for all Americans, whether you're a Muslim or a non-Muslim. Muslims, as Congressman Ellison spoke in the earlier segment, were one of the people who actually one of the early responders. And it's quite sad. I mean, everyone who lost a loved one that day understands how difficult it is. But one thing that we have to get take into consideration is that Muslims have played an important role in this society. And on the other hand, there are people who wish harm to America. And whether that person happens to be a Muslim or a Buddhist or a Jewish person or a Christian, in my opinion, they have to be taken to court and basically prosecuted, regardless of their religion or ethnic origin. Now, one thing I'd like to mention here is that, as you very well know, in the late 1990s, Eric Rudolph, who basically went on a series of bombing various abortion clinics around the United States and doing it out of his own religious belief. Now, we did not see a similar sort of mobilization to actually address the problem of, quote-unquote, the radicalization of the Christian community in the United States. Now, neither would I have ever actually suggested that this, something like this should ever happen. But with the same token, I would say that, you know, if a Muslim does something wrong, that person's religion should not be the driving force behind addressing the problem. And it's quite sad. I mean, of course, there are bad apples in every community, but those bad apples should never be the ones that actually represent that particular community.
Absolutely. Now, you know, I would agree that, you know, violence and radicalization is a serious issue that needs to be addressed on all levels in every society, including our own, you know, despite what the person's, you know, color, creed, or religion is. But I think one of the most frustrating aspects of these particular hearings is the fact that at this time there's widespread unemployment, there's corruption, we have two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as military involvement now in Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan. And are these hearings just a tactic for distracting Americans from real issues facing our country right now, such as, you know, what's happening in Wisconsin?
I mean, well, it could be, but I cannot speak to that. I mean, again, we could theorize as to why something like this is taking place, whether it's something to distract people from addressing the situations that are taking place nationally in Wisconsin and elsewhere. The fact that the unemployment rate is high and the economy is suffering seriously could be. I mean, yet at the same time, that is not, in my opinion, a legitimate reason to isolate an entire community of good Americans, people who've actually served in wars, people who pay taxes on time, educators, firefighters, sheriffs, etc. We cannot isolate that community. And this is, again, this is what makes America America and makes it, you know, a great nation and a great society. And for us to actually isolate an entire community based on their particular religious, you know, their particular religious identity is frankly problematic, especially that there is no data to suggest that. I mean, again, as I'm saying, is that, you know, I'm a pollster with my colleague Matt Pareto, and we've conducted the largest survey of Muslims, you know, who live in the United States, 22 different locations. A very interesting sample into this particular community. Now, one thing that we found is that, you know, Muslims are actually very good Americans. Again, you know, we are serving, we've actually looked at the Muslim American population in the United States. And one thing, you know, the reason why we wanted to address this is because of the lack of research that is out there. There are a couple of other research, for example, Princeton University professor Amani Jamal, who's conducted, in fact, the earliest study of mosques in New York City. And what we've done, we've actually replicated those sorts of studies, this similar study to that of Professor Amani Jamal, around the United States. Now, whether or not this is, you know, these particular hearings are there for, you know, as a reason to focus on something other than the economy, other than the unemployment, et cetera, I cannot hypothesize to that. But what I could say, again, is that, you know, Muslims should never be singled out in this particular case, and those who commit violence should face the fullest extent of the law.
Okay, Dr. Dennen, thank you so much for your time. We'll have to end there.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us here on Radio Tahrir.
Thanks for having me.
And next, we're going into a track three on our CD. Thank you. And the time is now 9:32 p.m. and you're listening to Radio Tahrir, Voices of the Arab and Muslim Communities, right here on 99.5 FM WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio. I'm Sadia Aslan, your co-host today, here with Sara Malaika. Be sure to join Radio Tahrir's group page on Facebook to send us feedback for behind-the-scenes pictures of our production team and a sneak peek of what will be on the show in the coming weeks. You can also access Tahrir's past programs via podcasts, comment on our blogs, and consult our rich archive of poems, songs, and interviews. That's www.radiotahrir.org. This week's featured blog by Barbara Nimri Aziz is entitled Libya, A New Demon to Demonize. And now for our next segment this evening, Sara Malaika. And you are listening to the work, the new work, Atash Surushan, Fire Angels. And to discuss this, I have on the line with me Niloufar Talebi. Niloufar Talebi is a writer, theater artist, and translator. She's the editor and translator of the anthology Belonging, New Poetry by Iranians Around the World in 2008. And the creator and performer of multimedia projects such as Icarus Rise and the Persian Rite of Spring. She's also the founding director of the Translation Project, a nonprofit organization dedicated to presenting Iran-inspired projects. She joins us on the line from San Francisco to tell us about her new work and the world premiere of Atash Surushan, Fire Angels, this coming week, March 29th at Carnegie Hall. Niloufar Talebi, thank you for joining us on Radio Tahrir.
Thank you for inviting me, and happy Nowruz to you and those of your listeners who celebrate it.
Yes, happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Well, we were just listening to this very, very beautiful music that we were listening to a little bit earlier before we started this segment. Can you tell us the story that accompanies this music, the story of Atash Surushan, Fire Angels?
Yes, the music that you were listening to is actually composed by Mark Gray, the composer of Atash Surushan. I'm the librettist of Atash Surushan, which means I wrote the poetry that is intertwined with the music. This piece will be sung by, we wrote it for the soprano Jessica Rivera, and it will be sung, it will world premiere at Carnegie Hall on March 29th and at Cal Performances for its West Coast premiere on April 3rd. The story, Atash Surushan, is essentially a love story in four movements. It also incorporates a reimagining of the events of September 11, 2001. It speaks to those events in a way, but it really essentially is a love story, and it imagines what sort of outcome, at least spiritually, would be the sort of the ideal outcome from such an event in a decade after those events that happened. It's also about understanding and closeness and connection rather than further divisions and lack of familiarity and distance. There are two characters in Atash Surushan, Mana and Asha. And these are philosophical concepts in other traditions, which I can talk about later, but I've personified them as people or as entities in this story. And they start off their story by not knowing anything about each other and under the assumption of difference, but they end after a wonderful, amazing collision that they've actually been one and the same thing all along.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of how it speaks to the events of September 11, but also it's really essentially a love story. Yeah.
So you mentioned the events of September 11th, and it's almost been 10 years now. And as I understand, this is a commissioned work. Where did the idea first come from for this project, and when did it begin?
This project is actually co-commissioned by Carnegie Hall, Cal Performances, and Meet the Composer. The idea for this project, originally, the composer, Mark Gray, approached me in 2007, actually, and we began speaking about doing a project possibly based on Persian poetry because of my past experience and past work with translating Persian poetry. But as the conversations evolved, fast forward to 2009, the soprano Jessica Rivera started working also with Mark on a piece that would be written exclusively for her. And so we brought all of our ideas and projects together, and we decided that by the time this project would premiere, it would be the 10th anniversary year of 9/11. So why not also sort of reflect on that event as well? We had a wonderful year in 2009 where all of us, Jessica Rivera, Mark Gray, myself, and also Molly Murkowski, the pianist for the show, had wonderful conversations over Skype, over telephone, over emails, and also in person in different cities and different countries, where we would sort of come up with the concept of how we could, you know, tackle this project. You know, we essentially wanted to do a love story, but we also wanted to allude to sort of a hopeful projection for the events of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote the piece in 2009, and Mark Gray wrote the music for the piece all of 2010. And so Jessica will be performing it next week at Carnegie Hall, and then the week after at Cal Performances in Berkeley.
And is this the first time you've written the libretto for a musical work?
Yes and no. Yes, because this is the first time I'm writing a libretto for a classical piece that's going to be sung. No, because I also wrote the text for my own theatrical piece, The Persian Rite of Spring, The Story of Nowruz, which world premiered in 2009, exactly a year ago. And this was a multimedia storytelling piece that was accompanied by original music by Bobak Salehi, which I myself narrated. So it wasn't sung, but I did write the text for a performance piece.
I'm speaking with Niloufar Talebi, writer and translator, about her new work in collaboration with many others, Atash Surushan, Fire Angels. And I'm Sara Malaika, and you're listening to Radio Tahrir on 99.5 FM WBAI. Niloufar, I know that you have drawn a lot from your background and your culture in Iran. But what other cultural traditions did you draw from for the creation of the libretto for this work?
Well, I actually ended up drawing inspiration from traditions that are neither Arab nor Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
I drew inspiration from predominantly from the pre-Islamic religion of Persia, which is called Zoroastrianism, which dates back thousands and thousands of years. I also ended up also drawing a little bit of inspiration from Oceanic and Polynesian thought and philosophy. The two characters, Mana and Asha, that appear in this love story, Mana is actually the Polynesian / Oceanic, as well as the Persian term for the divine life force that encompasses all of the universe, all of being. And Asha is the Zoroastrian philosophical term for truth and existence, and its realm is fire, which is why the title of the piece, Atash Surushan, which is means fire angels, refers to fire because I think that fire, as it is also thought of in the Zoroastrian tradition, as being a renewing element of renewal, not just destruction. Especially renewal after destruction, which I thought was perfect for as a title for this piece, which alludes to the events of September 11, 2001.
Yes, almost fire as a kind of nourishing force. You know, there's some types of I'm from the West Coast, and sometimes we have fires that go through the mountains, And yes. It's only at that time where there's certain flowers that come out from the earth, out only after the fires, the wildfires. And so, yes, you're right. We think of fire as a destructive force many times, but in many of the ancient cultures and ancient religions, it was not seen as a negative, as a purely negative.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Especially, it's regarded as, you know, an element of renewal after that destruction. So yes.
Mm-hmm. Now,
interesting about this work. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No, what's interesting about this work? In speaking with you, I realized that all the artists that are collaborating on this piece, myself, Mark Ray, the composer, Jessica Rivera, the soprano, Molly Murkowski, the pianist for the piece, and the leader of the Mime Ensemble, which will be the ensemble for the piece, and Maestro Donato Cabrera, we are all having our debuts at Carnegie Hall on this project.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
That's
I think
great.
It's exciting for all of us. This project has been in the making for many, many years, so I'm very excited.
And you mentioned that, you know, you're collaborating with all these different artists and professionals, and as I understand, you're all kind of in different places, so you had to kind of creatively work together to collaborate on this piece.
Yes, many Skype sessions, many meetings in different cities that we happened to at the same time find ourselves in. It was wonderful. At one point, Mark Ray and I met in Vienna because we happened to both be in Vienna. So it's a truly international project here.
Great. Sounds like a fun journey.
Yeah. And I think we all share the same goal. We all want the project to, we all imagine that what we want audiences to take away from this project is really the unity of humanity rather than, focusing on the differences and the perceived, actually, I should say, the perceived differences.
Absolutely.
Because there really are such, we're so close and we're so similar in so many ways, despite the surface differences. So this was what really brought us together as well.
Absolutely. Now, as an artist and a performer and a writer, you've been involved in so many different creative projects, and you've touched on this a little bit, but what do you think the arts can do for our society today? You know, earlier our first segment was about, something that you might call very destructive, some hearings that are going on today that can work to divide people. But what can art do? What can art do for our society today, and what can it do to communicate some different paths and different ideas?
Well, it's interesting because if you ask anybody to define art for you, they would define it differently. So it has, you know, infinite definitions. But whether we look at art as a mirror or a reflection of our times or as something that shapes our times, art is essentially the gateway into the imagination of every era. And it's, in a way, a map of the human experience. And it's the one place where the voices of humanity can be heard outside of the artifices of media and politicians, etc. Art, the creative process sparks the growth of the imaginations, and it enables us to make connections between things that are not previously connected, and therefore it really creates a new vision of the world. Now, that creative process does not only belong to artists or their audiences. It belongs to all of humanity. As we know, you talk about, creative thinking about this, creative thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
So it really can be applied to anything. And that I'm really believe that the arts arts and arts education is a universal remedy for really awakening the human imagination, the human spirit. And I think arts education should be for everyone, and it should be focused in every child's experience. Because it's through arts education and the experience of viewing art and making art that new audiences are born, new patrons of the arts are born, and a new human being that relies not just on knowledge but on their imagination is born. And that really changes the trajectory of history. As you know, Einstein said that imagination is more important than knowledge. And that's what the arts does for humanity. It sparks the imagination, the most important ingredient.
Yes, I love that it's a gateway into the imagination.
Yeah.
And, if there are listeners who are interested in coming to your gateway into the imagination, where can they find more information about this world premiere?
The world premiere at Carnegie Hall will be on March 29th at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, a week from tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, tickets for that could be bought at carnegiehall.org. And the West Coast folks who are in the Bay Area could purchase tickets at calperformances.org for the 3 p.m. performance at Hertz Hall on the UC Berkeley campus on April 3rd. You know, all that information is on my website as well, nilufartalabiba.com, but tickets are everywhere on calperformances.org and carnegiehall.org.
Okay, and just for our listeners, your website is nilufartalabi.com. It's nilufartalabi.com, and we'll link to that on radiotahrir.org. We're going to listen to a little bit more of just a little sample from Atash Surushan of Fire Angels. Nilufar Talabi, thank you so much for joining us this evening on Radio Tahrir.
Thank you so much, Sarah. See you soon.
Congratulations, and we'll
thank
see you,
you
next
much.
Week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
For some announcements. The Universal Muslim Association of America strongly condemns the unprecedented move of the Saudi government along with other Arab nations sending their troops into Bahrain and furthering the brutality and oppression against the innocent people of Bahrain. We stand together with the Bahraini people for their just rights and aspirations and appeal to the Muslim world to support the people of Bahrain. We join the call of all peace-loving individuals and organizations in requesting people to not stay quiet over these events. We cannot sit still while this oppression continues and rises. We request everyone to join supporters of freedom as United Voices will rally together and take a stand against the atrocious and violent acts by the governments of Bahrain, against its own citizens, as well as yet another example of oppression from the Saudi regime. The rally will be held on Sunday, March 27, 2011 at 11 a.m. The march will begin at the Saudi Consulate General in New York City and will proceed to the United Nations office. Again, this march is organized by the Universal Muslim Association of America and is the rally for the people of Bahrain, Sunday, March 27th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., beginning at the Saudi Consulate General in New York City.
كلنا عندهم دبابات احنا عنا حجار بيهدموا ببيوتنا بقتلوا بالاطفال يا فلسطين الاحرار يا غزة الابطال الصهيوني جاي لنهار ترا ترا ترا
Today on Radio Tahrir, we heard a report on New York Congressman Peter King's controversial hearings on what he calls the radicalization of the American Muslim community, and we spoke with Dr. Karam Dana. And we spoke to writer and theater artist Niloufar Talebi on the upcoming world premiere of Atash Surushan, Fire Angels, at Carnegie Hall, March 29th. Our featured music today was Faryad, Masters of Persian Music, Mohammad Reza Shajarian, Hossein Alizadeh, Kehan Kalhor, and Humayun Shajarian. And, of course, we go out every week with the music of Shadia Mansour. Special thanks to Max Schmid, our sound engineer, and our webmaster, Aydin Baldaji. Executive producer of Radio Tahrir is Dr. Barbara Nimri Aziz. I'm Sada Malaika, here with my co-host today, Sadia Aslam. For more information about Radio Tahrir and to get our podcasts, visit www.radiotahrir.org. That's RadioTahrir. Go in peace and health, and return in peace and health.
تسلم لما صفيهم على الفرد يا ابن العرة كلنا غزهم في العزة نزة كل الناس في احساس مش حماس ولا عباس لما شفت غزة انا شفت حالي شفت اطفال تتيبت من اي ضرر مع الاهلي اطفالي تموت وانا ابكي افتش على اولادي شفت لسوين طفل حضانة اختي تشهدت معلي تشهد لني شفت اخيرتي لما شفت المقاومة انا كونت بدي كونت بدي بس واقعي نصحني اجه
Morning Edge on World News with WBAI 99.5 FM and Al Jazeera English. Pacifica is the first radio network to broadcast Al Jazeera English over North American airwaves. Tune into the broadcast from 5 to 6 a.m. on weekdays for award-winning journalism of underreported stories from Al Jazeera's 65 news bureaus worldwide. That's the new Al Jazeera English News Hour at 5 a.m. Monday through Friday on WBAI 99.5 FM, exclusively on the Pacifica Radio Network.
People of America, this is the President of the United States. You are listening to George Galloway and the mother of all talk shows. George is a Scotsman, unlike me, an Irishman.
Last year, Mubarak declared George Galloway a persona non grata and threw him out of Egypt. Months later, he predicted the overthrow of the Egyptian regime, and now he foresees the fall of what he calls the Arab world's puppet presidents and corrupt kings. He wowed a WBAI audience at the New York Society for Ethical Culture with a speech on international politics. Now he will be on the air coming to you live and taking your calls with a brand new hour-long program called The Mother of All Talk Shows. Tune in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM following Democracy Now! Log on to WBAI.org for more information.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Ladies and gentlemen, join the award-winning Midnight Ravers on Friday, March 25th, 2011, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. as we proudly present This is Rebel Music. Hear how music that's been written in response to many of society's socio-political issues continues to inspire people around the world to get up and stand up for their rights. You don't want to miss this one, folks, so be sure to tune in. Again, that's Friday, March 25th, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. for the Midnight Ravers presentation of This is Rebel Music. Only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 on your FM dial.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your...
Hi, this is Gil Scott here, an unknown bluesologist, speaking to you on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. Stay here.
Somewhere between the light of day and edge of night lies the 5 o'clock shadow. Cutting edge journalism with Robert Knight. Exploring domestic and international affairs with live interviews and produced segments and a daily war summary. On the Razor's Edge with Robert Knight. That's 5 o'clock shadow. On WBAI 99.5 FM, Monday through Thursday at the obvious time.
WBAI, 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 New York, New York, New York, New York, WBAI, 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 New York, New York, New York, New York.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City, 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 City.
And that's where you were tuned.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive. Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.